Welcome back to Campbell Conversations with your host, Colin Campbell. And today is episode 204 of the podcast. And I'm joined by Dr. James McElroy. James is a qualified medical doctor and an entrepreneur who is widely recognized as a pioneer and a thought leader in the application of microbiome to treat disease and improve health. During this conversation, you can expect to learn just what a microbiome is, why it matters so much to your health and your life, James's entrepreneurial journey from his mum and dad's shed to raising tens of millions of dollars to build something that's truly quite special. Alongside that, I really start to understand what it takes to create an impact in the health and the medical industry and some of the mindset, mission, and purpose that James has driven forward with. This episode is a really deep look into health, wellness, using your mission and your purpose and your goal to drive you, as well as plenty of practical take-homes on optimizing for the best version of you and pursuing something that matters deeply to you. And the type of people that choose to listen to a podcast like this one, I think this one is going to resonate really, really strongly. Today's podcast is sponsored and supported by Vibe. Vibe is an international nutrition company supplying world-class meal replacement shakes and health supplements. Many of you will have seen on my Instagram story a number of different products that I use from Vibe, including the meal replacement shake, which I often have as a quick and easy breakfast when I'm getting started on my laptop during the day. And I want to tick off those key health boxes from a nutrition perspective, but also from a calorie perspective, and also keep me full through till lunchtime. Included in that is a whole range of vitamins, nutrients that keep me performing at my absolute best. Alongside that, and the one that always gets the most replies on my story when I post it, is Vibe's Lion Mane Mushroom Powder. I also take it as a capsule form, and ultimately it's something that I've looked at as a nootropic to build upon the foundations that I've got in terms of concentration, focus, clarity. Mushroom is something that I think more and more of us are going to become open-minded to in the next few years. And I'm definitely jumping on that trend early and trying to benefit from the Lion's Mane Mushroom Powder that Vibe have. And I feel like I'm at my most articulate, verbose, and most focused as I build up, coming up for, I think, 8 weeks of taking mushroom powder for now. And the last, but certainly by no means least, and including a product that Dr. James himself references within this podcast, is Vibe's world-class greens powder, which I think we can all admit we're not eating enough fruit and vegetables, even the most diligent of us. And this is a surefire way to tick that box in a tasty, efficient, and healthy way. And you can get involved at the Vibe website, whether you're in the UK, EU, or across in Australia or wherever you are. Check out Vibe. The link will be in the show notes, and you can use the code CAMPOD, CAMPOD, for 15% off either of the websites that you go on. I want to say a massive thank you for the continued support of the podcast. We are in an incredible place where I get to have conversations like this one with Dr. James, and it cannot keep happening unless people like you make sure you're subscribed or following and share this episode with a friend. It's been a little while since we've had an episode that's been blasted on Instagram stories, and I've been resharing it all week when it's come out. So please, let's make that one, or this release, that episode again, and please do blast your Instagram story and tag me at call.cambro. But that's quite enough from me. You've got almost an hour and a half after this music's played with myself and Dr. James McElroy. Dr. James, we're in the studio together. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, man. Appreciate that a lot.
And I've got so many different topics that I think we could cover. But for starters, I want to understand, where did your interest in the gut and microbiome start?
The gut microbiome. So basically, 24-hour computer laboratory at the University of Edinburgh. The year was 2013-14. And I was sat flicking through academic journals, doing a very nerdy form of procrastination. And I was looking for a topic to write my dissertation on, essentially. I didn't have one. So I was going click, 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 click. And you know how when you're on YouTube, you sometimes end up, because of the algorithm, in some really weird place? That's what happened to me. And I came across this paper that essentially showed that if you move microorganisms from a thin, lean mouse into an overweight mouse, then the overweight mouse lost weight, and vice versa. And I thought, wow, that's incredible. And that year I tried to start a couple of businesses, One was a personal training consultancy, which failed absolutely miserably. We can talk about that. And the other was this drink to try and ameliorate and prevent MDMA-induced neurotoxicity in essentially ravers. And that had a bit more traction, and I created this product and I sold a bit of it, but I was kind of looking for my next thing in addition to the dissertation topic. And I was just like, this is one of the coolest things I've ever seen. It was in Nature. Jeffrey Gordon was the researcher, very eminent. And I immediately thought, has that been done before in humans? Because that could be a game changer. And actually, what is the microbiome? I've done 4 years of medical school and I never heard of the microbiome before.
It hadn't come up.
Never come up. No one had ever said anything about the microbiome. So I started to do some more research on the microbiome and was just like, oh, this is unbelievable. There's like this hidden microbial majority that lives on and inside of our bodies. There's 100 trillion microorganisms. Back then, it's changed a little bit now, but back then people said it was 10 to 1, so 10 microbial cells to one human cell, so we were more microbial than human. And then I just essentially fell in love with this field very, very quickly. Because I realized that a lot of the things that I'd been learning about at medical school, these chronic, quote-unquote, incurable or currently incurable diseases, may be driven by the microbiome and the gut. So within about 6 months, I'd come across another area within this microbiome field. And for the listener, microbiome refers to all the microorganisms that inhabit a particular environment, all of their genes, and everything that they produce. And because they're living cells, like little factories, they produce all sorts of amazing things that can be helpful but also unhelpful depending on the context. And I realized that the microbiome was a therapeutic target for drug development. And this concept of moving microorganisms from one animal to another had also been done in human beings. And it was called fecal microbiota transplantation, also known as FMT, now known as intestinal microbiota transfer. And I just realized that it was an incredibly powerful and effective means of potentially treating disease.
One of the most interesting aspects you've mentioned already is that it went from a lean mouse to an overweight mouse, and it had a difference. And I recently interviewed Andrew Craig on the podcast, who is writing a book called The Future is Biotech. Mm-hmm. And he is absolutely set on the fact that if we can address some of the problems from a biotech perspective with the gut, we can deal with things like diabetes, yeah, obesity, more mental challenges like autism, yep, behavioral challenges like ADHD, etc., etc., yep, because our microbiome has been compromised by today's modern environment. Talked about metals briefly as well, but I won't go super deep on that because I know that that's an area that you're going to be able to speak to more than anyone else. But I found that fascinating because I come from a school of health and fitness, and many of the listeners will as well, where calories in, calories out is the most important thing. Yeah. And while I'm not going to discredit that entirely, there are factors around that that are extremely important as well. And we've seen some pseudoscience around that where people are talking about certain things and selling particular programs. Right. But understanding that perhaps if your microbiome is compromised, your appetite, your hunger hormones like ghrelin, etc., could be seriously compromised, where you do find it impossible to adhere to a calorie controlled diet. For so sure. I find when you reference straight away, one of the first things you saw was the transfer between a healthy lean mouse and an overweight mouse that wasn't as healthy. When you swapped their microbiome, the results were and the outcomes were different.
Yeah, and what they showed also in that study was that they provided some mechanistic rationale. So they showed that the overweight mouse had a microbiome which was more efficient at energy harvest. So it extracted more calories from the food that went into the mouse. And there's a similar school of thought in humans, which is that the microbiome in an overweight person might be better at extracting calories from food. Because when food goes into your body, depending on the makeup of food, there's some aspects that you break down, and you've got your anatomy and your physiology, and you can break that down, for example, protein to amino acids. But very often, particularly if you've got fruit and veg on your plate, there's aspects you cannot break down. It's the microbiome that breaks these aspects down. So you have your fiber, digestible, soluble, insoluble, And then the insoluble side, the more complicated carbohydrates, are what the microbiome feeds on. So it's entirely plausible for me anyways, that people who might be struggling to lose weight or that gain weight very quickly have a microbiome which is better at harvesting energy. Now, from an evolutionary point of view, that's a great thing because food's always been scarce up until relatively recently. But now it's not a good thing because wherever you go, there's maximally processed, minimally nutrient dense,
hyper-palatable,
very high calorie food everywhere. The other thing which is really important is that I am quite sure that the microbiome drives cravings. Your gut is connected to your brain. There's a nerve called the vagus nerve, which connects your gut and your brain.
You're going to laugh. I've written this down because I was doing my research to be ready for this. But yeah, that was the exact term.
So there's a vagus nerve, which is critically important for a variety of things. And then there's other means in which the microbiome communicates with the brain. So if the microbiome produces small molecules, they can move into the bloodstream and then communicate with the brain. So we're just starting to understand all of that. To be honest with you, and I've said it previously somewhere, I think the interaction between the microbiome and the mind could be the most complicated thing in the universe. I think it actually could be the most complicated thing there is to decipher. And we're a long, long way away from that. But to bring you back to the interest, for some reason, I don't know why, I just latched onto this. And within a few months, we'd started the first version of the company. And it was called Aberdeen Fecal Therapy, because we were in Aberdeen at the time. I was training to be a doctor in Aberdeen at the time. And the vision then was actually kind of similar to what it is now, which was we believe that it's possible to prevent and treat disease through enhancing the microbiome. And we're going to somehow set up a company that's going to do that. Now, I knew nothing about nothing. I didn't have a degree. I was still at medical school. I knew nothing about drug development, nothing about the regulations, nothing about pharmaceutical manufacturing, nothing about raising investment, nothing about building a team, creating culture, intellectual property, patents, nothing. But I had this conviction, this gut feeling, which was, this could be huge. And I was very excited about preventing and treating disease through the microbiome. And that's always been the driver. It's not been about, oh, let's raise all this money and you get all the fanfare, let's get into Forbes, blah, blah, blah. It's never been about that. It's always been about, and it still is today, how do we help people through the microbiome? Because we all have a compromised microbiome. You're right. By virtue of being in a 21st century industrialized Western society, all of us has a compromised microbiome in some respects. And it's up to us as individuals to change that. And there's lots of things that we can do to improve our microbiome. Every time we put something into our mouths, we're doing something to the microbiome. But then there's things like what we're doing at Enterobiotics, which have potentially massive and far-reaching impact on the global microbiome, if you like. Another thing to note, which I think is kind of interesting, is everything's a microbiome, essentially. There's a microbiome everywhere. There's a microbiome in your sink, there's a microbiome in your ear, there's a microbiome in the coral reefs, there's a microbiome everywhere. And a lot of the principles that apply to the gut microbiome are the same as microbiomes elsewhere.
Does that make it easier to research then? Because we can look at these other areas?
Yes, a little bit. What's really interesting is that, for example, dogs have microbiomes distinct to dogs, and you wouldn't find really much crossover at all between the microbes in your dog's gut and your gut. Likewise, in a cow's gut. Cows have a very complicated digestive tract, and the bacteria are fundamental to what they do in terms of being able to ferment. But some of the principles are ubiquitous. So, for example, one key principle is, if you have diversity, so you have many different types of species, so different types of bugs, and they're spread evenly, that's a proxy for health. That's a good thing. So think about your coral reef. You know, a healthy, vibrant coral reef is colourful, it's teeming full of life, there's variety, versus the bleached, dead coral reef that you see sometimes now because of increases in temperature. Similar to your microbiome. In your gut, you want a microbiome in your gut that's really diverse and that's vibrant, and that's because it has lots of functional potential and you want it to have lots of functions. If you've taken steps yourself, either through your own choice or through necessity, that's damaged your microbiome. Classics are antibiotics, which we have historically given out like sweeties. Chemotherapy, which typically is essential. Or, I mean, we're in Glasgow. A diet that doesn't have any fiber and that's really full of...
Hyper-processed foods. High alcohol.
Exactly. I mean, I think this Glasgow effect, and this is a well-studied health, economic, societal, public health phenomenon, which is that for some reason people in Glasgow just live less long. I think that's driven by the microbiome, and that's a result of diet.
Oh, and lifestyle, yeah.
And lifestyle, exactly. You know, Scotland, some parts of Scotland are incredibly healthy. Some parts of Scotland are extremely unhealthy, and we're potentially the worst in the world with regards to some metrics, you know, drug death being the classic example. But I think a lot of that comes back to gut health and the microbiome. And gut health and microbiome health are intertwined, but they're slightly different. You know, the gut health refers to the entirety of your intestinal tract from your mouth to your bum. There's microbes all over that. And there's a slightly different microbiome in your upper GI tract to your lower GI tract. But generally speaking, if both of them are in a good place, then they kind of, they're synergistic and they're mutual. But if one tips, then it impacts the other. And a concept that we should discuss is the chicken and the egg. You know, what comes first? Damage to your microbiome and then damage to your gut and damage to the rest of your body, or damage to your body through inflammation that has an impact on your gut microbiome? It's difficult to tell.
Before we go there, you got interested in 2013, 14, you're mentioning.
Yep.
At that point in time, I would say it was an incredibly niche topic. At this point in time, there is actually a greater recognition that the gut, at least, maybe not microbiome, although we do see people talk about probiotics and stuff nowadays, which is a positive move in the right direction, I would suggest, albeit not the kind of the Z in the alphabet, if we're, say, for example, where it would be your C just now. But how has that affected business, research, and the things that you're working on, the fact that it's now more in the public consciousness?
So it's absolutely true that from a societal, quote-unquote, layperson's perspective, gut health and the term microbiome is much more widely understood, and people are actively taking steps to try and work on their gut health. And that's brilliant. It's great. It means that in many conversations, we're kind of pushing at an open door. But the microbiome drug development field, which is where I sit, has been through many ups and downs since 2013. It's been through roaring highs and really lows. And that's because in any new field, in any kind of novel area of technological development, there are early successes and there are cycles of boom and bust, just like the internet as an example. And there is a curve, a technology adoption curve, and I've forgotten the name. And there's an initial hype, and then there's a dip, and then there's another hype, and then it kind of just goes up. And broadly speaking, when I started, there were a few leading companies, and I aspired to be like them. They're based in the US. There's one in the UK. And typically, when something's really hot, quote unquote, and there's a lot of money around because we're not in a recessionary environment, cost of capital has been cheap, then these companies can raise huge amounts of money with very little proof and very little evidence. So we had that in the microbiome. We had some early companies raising boatloads of money because microbiome was the thing. Everyone who was a who's who in investors wanted in on the microbiome because they didn't want to miss out. And we're kind of in a bit of a down at the moment. And that's despite there being phenomenal progress in terms of drugs developed. So in 2013, there were no approved microbiome drugs. You could say antibiotics are microbiome drugs, but I'm talking about drugs that are composed of bacteria and other microorganisms. There's two approved drugs there in the USA, which is a huge deal. And I listened to the earnings transcript for one of the leading companies yesterday, and they're saying they're seeing some positive signals in terms of early adoption of the drug, which is fantastic. But the positive public perception is not mirrored by the investor community at this particular moment in time. There's a few believers, but there's a lot of skeptics. And Big Pharma, who are essential to the success of drugs, are not fully bought into the microbiome at this particular point in time. So
what are some of the factors that are holding them back?
If you think about the drug that Interbiotics is developing, this is a capsule that contains billions of microorganisms, and they're not all the same. And we're not quite sure exactly how it works. We're confident, and we have data that shows that we can make batches of it that hit the same specification every single time, which is important. But at the cellular level, it's slightly different every single time. And it's not a small molecule, and it's not a protein. It's not a monoclonal antibody. It's very new, and it's very different to what they're used to. So there's an element of, I think they don't understand it. And if they don't know and understand something, and there's 50,000 opportunities available for them,
they'll put their money into the ones that are more easy for them to be reassured by.
Yes, and they will wait until it's later down the development path. So to take a drug from start to finish, you sometimes have a target, and then you try and find something that attaches to or blocks the target. Or you start with some novel new chemical entity, and you see what it does to lots of different targets. And then that happens in test tubes, and then you move to typically animal experiments where you try to establish what the maximum sort of dose is likely to be and how it impacts on the animal's physiology. Then you move to a healthy human volunteer study. Then you move to patients, and then you go to a bigger study which has statistical powering and so on. That process could take 10 years, cost over £1 billion. And the later the drug is down that path, the more valuable it is to the company, the closer it is to market, the less risky it is. So Big Pharma sometimes come in right at the start and they take that risk. But they have so much money, they'd rather just, at this point in time for microbiome, wait until there's phase two data or phase three data. And for them, the difference between paying 50 million and 500 million is actually a bit of like a rounding error. It doesn't matter. So they'd rather wait until the risk is gone, then allocate the resource, take the asset. So I think there's an element of not understanding. It's not traditional, and there needs to be more proof points.
Proof of concept.
But fundamentally, if the data is good and a company or companies show that this has a meaningful, statistically significant impact on a disease with high unmet need and a significant market potential, Big Pharma will come in.
The investors will come. It's a timeline thing for them as well, isn't it? Because they'll have a plan on ROI that they'll promise their investors before. And I've heard you speak previously that there's no promises that this would have a huge return within 5 years. Within 10 years, it could be a longer time frame than that. And if their investors are less capital rich at this point in time, then of course they're going to try and bet on something that they know will potentially have a return within a shorter time frame.
Definitely. And the other thing to say is, counterintuitively, we want all of our competitors to be very successful, because if a group of investors makes a load of money on a microbiome company, that's good for us, because we can say, well, look, you know, we think we're better than them because of X, Y, and Z. Their investors have come in and made a load of money. You should come and invest here and make a lot of money too. And we're very hopeful that these two approved drugs in the US do very, very well. Because if they do, again, we can use that as a benchmark. So the field is matured. The technology is developing. Some companies have risen and fallen. And you'd be surprised at how much money some of these companies have raised who have now fallen, like hundreds of millions of pounds. And that's a shame, because obviously investors have got burnt if they've if that company's flopped. Now, the good news is the patients and society more generally are now bought in because they're listening to gut health podcasts, they're wanting to test their microbiome, they're reading books on the microbiome, there's BBC4 documentaries, it's on the radio all the time, everyone's talking about it, everyone's drinking kombucha, everyone wants to do more. There's a lot of TikTok and Instagram influencers talking about bloating, it's not normal, do this, do that, and improve your bloating. This is all great. And we're creating demand. And once we've got approvals and ideally some big pharma buy-in, we should be able to
distribute and get it out there.
Successful.
Interestingly, because of the nature of how quiet the sector was back when you were starting, I suspect you probably came up against more inertia that meant you had to fall back on this purpose and drive that you had in behind as well. Because when I speak to you now, you're incredibly enthusiastic and engaged on it. You're articulate. You're able to speak about whatever area of it there is because you're a subject matter expert. But in those early days when you've maybe got this vision, how do you get through that period when there's maybe not so much encouragement from the outside world?
I mean, during the early days, people laughed at me. And I didn't actually know that much about the microbiome. And I remember I used to go to these gut conferences, British Society of Gastroenterology, and stand up in front of hundreds of consultants and professors and say, "Hi, my name's James, a medical student, and I'm building this business. I'd be keen to talk to anyone who wants to help me make it happen. I want to make this fecal transplantation thing next generation," and da-da. Just fearless. And I think if you believe in something enough, you find a way. Speak to any successful entrepreneur who's built something from nothing. They'll tell you it's like relentless resilience and grit and drive. And you put your head on the pillow every night and you go, "Yep, I'm going to do this." You wake up every morning and you go, "Yep, I'm going to do this." And you make it happen. Now, of course, you know, during the early days, there was a huge amount of inertia. But there wasn't really a rush because I was at medical school. And I didn't have to think about salary. And it was kind of fun. It's all new and exciting. I was going to these business pitching competitions and stood up, come back home with a check for 500 quid, eventually 20 grand. And those little things build your confidence. But I've always believed, for some reason, that this was going to be successful. And failure has never been an option. You have to be comfortable with failure because you get kickbacks and knockbacks all the time. And through failure comes growth and so on. But I refuse to believe that this is going to fail because I fundamentally believe in what we're doing at Enterobiotics in terms of its potential. And it's been like that since day one. And if you ask anyone who met me in 2014, there's videos online. It's the same. I'm telling you the same thing. I don't sound that different. I was talking about the microbiome. The microbiome is important. We've got this vision and we're going to execute on the vision. And now here we are, 30 years old, bit of gray hair. It's the same story. But now we've got a phase two clinical trial. We're just about to start another phase two clinical trial. We're going to make the product available on a named patient basis later this year. And who knows, in a few years, maybe tens of thousands of people could be taking this. And that's what it's all about. It's about people who are currently unwell, through no fault of their own, taking some of our capsules and going back in the garden with the kids, or going back to work, or going on that holiday, or not having to worry about, "God, where's the nearest toilet? Because I don't want to go outside unless I know where the toilet is because I need to run to the loo." That's not a great way to live your life. And there's patients out there right now who I believe don't just want our product, they need our product. And I feel this great deal of responsibility to these patients to get it to them. And sometimes, you know, when you're at work, you kind of lose sight of that a little bit. You've got this fire to put out, that fire to put out, we've got this HR thing, da, da, da. But
the overarching mission is bigger than that.
Absolutely. And it's been the same since day one. Let's try and do something to help people. Now, we want all of our investors to make a superb, spectacular return. I want all of the investors at Enterobiotics, bigger, smaller, earlier, later, all of them should get a superb return because they've put their capital at risk and they've believed in day one, me, 2023, the management team, the business, the board. But it's the same thing. This is risky. This is drug development. This is competitive. It's capital intensive. But no, I'm going to back James and his team. So I would like all of them to do extremely well. But we will make them do well through delivering on the vision, which is best-in-class medicine for multiple different diseases and patient populations.
When we were getting organised for this, we were speaking about the importance of environment and the different places that you've spent time. I know you've gone across to many different countries and cities and environments to seek inspiration and gain knowledge.
Yep.
How important has that been for you?
Oh, massively important. I mean, I've had the honour and the privilege of a very close relationship with some exceptional people. I classify my family actually as exceptional people because my dad is the epitome of positivity. You know, he's not a multimillionaire, billionaire. He didn't build a business or sell a business, but my dad is glass half full, 24/7, 365. It's unbelievable. And he's 70 years old. And he's still got so much energy, I can't even keep up sometimes. So I've always had that, him and they, he always said, yeah, you do that. You just try it. You just go for it. You go for it. And then I had my mum, who's a bit more cautious, but so supportive. And they've always been supportive along this journey. So I classify them as exceptional people and the rest of my family as well have been fully supportive. So that's one element, which I think is really important. And I'm so lucky to have that because some people don't. They also put some money in to help get it going in the early days. And we don't talk about this very often because now we're a very serious biotech, but there was a lot of time spent in the garden shed trying to do stuff with support from my dad and my mum because we didn't know any better. And over the years, people have just entered into the picture. I've always got myself out there and networked like mad and stood up whenever there was an opportunity and to tell people about what I'm trying to do. Always put my hand up first. And but people have just arrived at different times. So the first chairman that came in at Interbiotics, this unbelievable guy, Colin Bennett, what on earth was he doing with his track record coming to join me, a 21-year-old medical student, starting a biotech company in a shed? Reputationally for him, that's pretty blooming.
High risk.
He never took a penny from the business. Not even £1. And his story, and I'm going to try and get him on my podcast because he's so unbelievable, this guy, was I saw something in you. I believe in the potential. I just want to help people. So he came in and he helped me develop and I made a lot of mistakes. And then I've had a great relationship with the biggest investor in Enterobiotics, a guy called Mark Bamforth and his wife, Morag. Mark, for 3 years, has spoken to me every week. And this guy, you can look him up, unbelievable businessman. But he's taking the time to mentor me in addition to backing the business. And now I've got a new chairman, new boss, who was previously CEO at a global pharmaceutical company. And he's been really hands-on. And prior to that, someone called Douglas Thompson spent a lot of time with me, helping me develop. So my close circle of people in a work context are all amazing, supportive, exceptional people. And in terms of my friend group, I might seem quite extroverted to you, but actually I do a hell of a lot myself and spend a lot of time myself. You know, I'm always out in the hills on my own. I go on holiday on my own because I like that thinking time. I like to think about what I do next. But I do believe that you are, in some respects, a result of the people you surround yourself with. Now, there's not that many life science entrepreneurs in Scotland, but I've got a huge amount of value from making friends with other entrepreneurs, spending time with other entrepreneurs.
In different sectors, but on the same path.
Yep. and athletes. And I get a huge buzz out of spending time with people who are excellent at anything, whether it's languages, singing, dancing, yoga, paper folding, meditation. I just get a huge buzz out of that. Because I think the pursuit of excellence in any discipline is quite similar.
Yeah, I'll use a medical term. It's almost infectious, isn't it?
It's infectious, and you've got to put the work in. So now, we talked a little bit before the podcast about Scotland and all these places I've been. There's no doubt that if you want to build a multi-billion pound, globally competitive company, there's some parts of the world where there are deeper talent pools, more readily available capital, bigger checks, specialist investors, specialist lab space. And to be a successful biotech business, you need a bit of all of that. You need a talent pool, so you need the best people you can find. You need a conducive regulatory environment, which we do have in the UK. You need investors that understand and that have deep enough pockets and that are patient. You ideally need some big pharma. And there's just something about, if there's lots of other companies, there's like an energy, there's like a buzz. And I love Scotland. I love this country. But one of the things that makes me a little bit sad is that we used to be the best at so many things. I don't just mean best in Europe, but we were the best in the world at many things. And many of them also included manufacturing. We talked about steel and architecture and shipbuilding and textiles.
Telecommunications, you spoke about.
And telecommunications and technology. And for a long time, at various different points in history, Scotland was the epicenter of philosophical thinking, or, you know, telecoms or technology, you know, the Clyde. I think the first hovercraft that was ever manufactured was manufactured in the Clyde, because they were just so innovative. And we had this huge manufacturing base, which is gone. And nowadays, when you think about Scotland as a world leader, you're kind of going, what are we the world leader?
There's very few industries. Whiskey, perhaps.
Whiskey, yeah, but the Japanese are now innovating.
They're coming, yeah.
I'm joking. No, I don't know much about whiskey, and I think there's some amazing people here in whiskey. But you're kind of, you know, you're drawn to whiskey. You're drawn to scotch, as the Americans say. You know, it'd be great to say, well, actually, you know, AI, we're unbelievable. Antimicrobial resistance. This is the hub. Microbiome. We could be the best at microbiome in the world. We have such a rich history of microbiome research in this country. We were the experts at the Rowett Institute for decades. But there's not that many microbiome companies in Scotland. So when I go to Boston, West Coast of America, you know, even sometimes London, Oxford, Cambridge, Japan, Tokyo, Singapore, which I've been to in recent times, I feel a different buzz. And we need to do something about that in this country, because we could and should be globally competitive. We've got all the raw ingredients, all there. We're very innovative people. We are entrepreneurial people, but what we don't have is the American isms. The
American dream.
The American dream. You know, we're going to be the best. We're going to be the biggest. We're going to be the first. We're going to be the fastest. We're going to crush all the competition, and we're going to globally dominate. That's the American mentality. Second place in America, no, does not exist. Second place is a failure. You know, when you speak to an American investor about your business, they go, are you raising enough money? How are you going to crush the competition? How am I going to make lots of money, James? You go to a Scottish investor and they kind of get glasses out and sort of looking at all the numbers and the minutiae, going, oh, this is quite risky, isn't it? Oh, that's a lot of money you're
different
spending
mindset.
Every month. That's a lot of money you're spending every month, James. That's, valuation's too high. America is totally different. The American mindset is so different. It's let's just dominate and let's be globally competitive from day one.
Has a lot of that rubbed off on you then?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think by nature, I've always been, particularly in the business context, a little bit American. I don't want to be second place. I'm not happy about that. I say frequently, and I need to be careful because I'm in a public forum at the moment, but we do want to crush our competition. We don't want to be second best. Sorry, but in a new field like this, very often, you know, it's kind of winner takes all. Although, as I said, we want our competitors to be successful.
To prove concept, you want them to be successful, but you want to be leading the way.
But I've had the, and it's been a privilege and it's been an honour to be mentored and to be supported by American Scottish businessmen who invested in Enterobiotics and have been on the board for 3 years. It's two people, Mark Bamforth, Ian Baird. And it can be tough. We don't always agree. But if it wasn't for those two, there wouldn't be an Enterobiotics. And I've learned a hell of a lot from those two. And they've saved my bacon, to use an American phraseology, a fair few times. And what I learned very quickly from them was the strategic elements, the big picture. How do we go faster? Is always how they're thinking. And they're comfortable with risk. They understand that if you want to win, you've got to take risks. So that's rubbed off on me. At some point, I'd like to spend some more time in the US, career-wise, just to immerse myself in it. But as I said, I think for a Scottish entrepreneur, I'm quite American in some respects, even though I've never lived there and I'm not American. But I do want to be the best. I'm not satisfied with second place. I'll be very upset, actually, if we're second place. Never mind third place. We need to be the best. And we're building a best-in-class business at Enterobiotics. We want to have the best product. We want to have the best facilities. We want to have the best people. And that will create the best company.
As a young founder, what did you do right to get these people working alongside you?
I think it's the conviction, the drive, the determination, the ambition, the vision, the clear vision. And there was some track record as well, because I've done something that very few people have ever done. I mean this in the least big-headed, showy off.
No, but if the facts are there, I want to hear it. Yeah.
I don't know if there's anyone else who started a biotech company at medical school, completed their degree, and then taken a new drug, into a clinical trial. And that balance that I did for years of medicine, degree in physiology, Enterobiotics, raising the seed round, raising the Series A, when I look back, was a feat. And the only reason it happened was of this unwavering desire and belief and
force of nature pushing it forward. I think there's a lot to be proud of in that respect. And I actually found a funny quote. It's from a 2017 video on YouTube. One of your colleagues at the time, Nick Robinson, he said he didn't know how you were able to get so much done. It seems like you've got 30 hours instead of everyone else's 24.
I can't recall what that is, but well, you know, he's another guy. I need to reach out to him again. He's another amazing guy. He didn't have to do what he did for me and us. He came out of retirement to help me do this. And he must have seen something in me and believed in what we were doing. I remember I met him. He turned up as if he was coming to a job interview. I didn't know what a production manager did. And I remember he had this book out and he said, so have you got a quality management system? I said, no. Said, okay, have you got a site master file? I said, no. He said, okay, you got any SOPs, standard operating procedures? I said, no. He said, have you got anything? It's like, no. Can you help me? For some reason, he said, yeah, I'm coming on. So then me and Nick formed this quite close team. And we worked really well because I had this vision. I was going to get the money and he was going to help me set the facility up. You know, if Nick hadn't come into my life, it wouldn't have happened. I think the force of nature thing is in some respects accurate. I've been described as that a few times before.
Well, I can see it.
But I think people just enthusiasm, gravitate.
You bring people with you. So you're talking about Nick, you've mentioned Mark, you mentioned
Colin Bennett.
Colin was one of the other people. They subscribed to your enthusiasm, your energy, your vision, your mission.
Right.
And of course there was an element of a track record, but there was also just this mission statement, this purpose that was pushing them forward as well. And people of that level aren't easily led. They aren't easily swayed by a snake oil salesman, so to speak, if you think about some of the different things that people sell nowadays in terms of visions and dreams. They would follow somebody that is credible. And that's a massive credit to you at such a young age, and even at 30 now, the level of authority you command within that field is such that people are willing to put their time in, put their money where their mouth is, and follow you on that quest.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I look back and just go, whoa, how did that even happen? Because now I feel like we really have something compelling. Like now I feel like, you know, we very soon could be a multi-billion pound business, because we've got all the raw ingredients that are kind of coalescing together. And with some good data from these clinical trials, that could be us. We could be on that rocket ship, just... And now I can see it. And I think now when we pitch to very serious investors and pharmaceutical companies, it's, you know, it's not the James McElroy show anymore. It's Enterobiotics.
And you're a part of the story, but you're not the only part. That's important.
Yeah. I mean, for a while during the very, very early days, I thought I was bigger than the business because I didn't know any better. And it was me. I was the only employee. And then it kind of grew a little bit and it was still the James McElroy show. And I was quite emotional and da-da-da. But now I'm kind of cool as a cucumber. I'm employed as CEO. Yes, I'm the founder. But I'm here to do a great job for the board and the shareholders. So my founder mentality is still there. I'm still acting like a founder, evangelizing everywhere I go, driving people forward, coalescing people, getting them excited. But I'm now, you know, also thinking like I'm an employed CEO. What's the right thing for the company? What's in the company's best interest? What's the best thing for our shareholders? How do we create value for shareholders and add value to society? And it's really great that I've had that experience and I'm having this experience now as well. The business at day one needs a different CEO to the business at day 365. And it needs a different CEO 3 years. And either the founder evolves or the founder shifts out and you bring someone else in.
A lot of the audience are familiar with the Gymshark story where Ben Francis was calm and stoic enough to step away as CEO. He brought in Steve Hewitt. I've interviewed Paul Richardson, who came in as chairman. And Paul spoke about the fact that you could have these visionary founders like Ben Francis and Lewis Morgan at that point in time who could drive it forward, but they needed a lot of business acumen that they wouldn't have as mid-20-year-olds because how could they? So I think it's great that people are more aware of that now. If they're thinking about their entrepreneurial journey, they will need to stand on the shoulders of giants, would be a term that I would use.
Yeah, I mean, what a story. The Gymshark story is an incredible story. And that's a hyper growth business. And it started with an idea and the founders had the drive and sprinkling of good luck, which we all need. And to have the humility to step away, like he's done, he's still involved, is what's helped him, I think, go the next level. Some founders don't. Some founders just can't do it. I mean, from my perspective, if there ever comes a time where I'm not the right person to lead Enterobiotics, and I recognize that and the board recognizes that, then we'll have a conversation and we'll do the right thing for the company. And it comes back to what I just said a few minutes ago. We've always got to do the right thing for the business. And you know what? I'm totally comfortable with that. Now, I'm very happy in my role. And I still feel like there's so much left to do here at EBX and with the microbiome. And I want to be part of the story where people are taking our medicine. And I know that I've driven that and driven that and driven that through all the ups and downs. But I've also got other business ideas, some of which I'd quite like to do now. And maybe I can in a couple of years with a bit more support. It's all biotech and health. It's not like I want to do like a restaurant or something like that. Yeah. Maybe I would like a poke bar and health food, but I've got other biotech ideas that I'd like to be able to pursue, but it's not right for me to do so right now because I'm laser focused on EBX and creating value for the shareholders.
Yeah, I understand that.
But maybe you want to take it on as the founder and drive it forward. You've got a big reach. Some of the ideas I've got just need someone passionate, enthusiastic, who's willing to learn and who's got a big reach. Because I've been doing drug development for the last 7 years. I'd like to learn a little bit more about B2C and learn a little bit more about the marketing, because I think a lot of what we've done at EBX could be applied to a B2C opportunity like probiotics, healthy drink or something like that. So I'm looking, you know, if there's a listener, if there is a listener on this podcast
that wants to get in touch, they can drive it.
Please reach out to me because I've already got something that's nearly baked. And it just requires a bit of energy and enthusiasm to take it to the next level.
I like that. Yeah, that's the beauty of long form content. You can engage people in your story and your ideas, and the people that listen to long form content, I think, have an advantage over those people that are just stuck on their phone scrolling TikTok in that regard. But as a founder, I am continually impressed by how focused you are on your own health and well being. And I suppose given the research you've done and the information you know about the gut and your health, that's very important. And one of the things that I wrote down was that you've said publicly before that you are a massive believer in the power of nutrition, sleep, exercise as tools to improve mood and improve health before we think about medical intervention.
Definitely.
What are some of those things within your life that you try and nail?
Well, I don't think there'd be a need for many of the medicines and a need for a lot of big pharma if people actually just did the basics. And that sounds like a bit like conspiracy theory, you know.
Functional medicine's on the rise. I've had a lot of guests maybe they are on the extremes of shunning the medical world, particularly given what maybe happened over the last couple of years, and I would probably sit on that side of the fence as well.
Yeah.
But there is a lot to be said for integrating some of the ancestral wisdom and the functional medicine aspects that people online are now promoting and talking about without maybe swallowing the whole hog.
100%. So, look, I think if the whole population of Scotland exercised every day, prioritised their sleep, didn't smoke, stopped drinking alcohol, and eat minimally processed whole foods, then the life expectancy would go up significantly and the hospitals would be empty. We wouldn't have a staffing crisis. We wouldn't have an NHS crisis. We'd have fit, happy, enthusiastic, strong people walking around everywhere.
Before we go deeper on that, James, you said
I'll
the word...
I'll talk about my own stuff if you want. No, go on, but please.
You said the word happy there.
Yep.
And that's what I want to ask about just quickly before we carry on, because the gut links very heavily to the brain. We talked about the vagus nerve, for example. Yep. And I've had a guest... Kayla Barnes, this was a couple of years ago now, but I remember quite distinctly what she was talking about, and she absolutely blew up on Instagram, and she's been quite controversial in that the mental health crisis is quite heavily driven by hyper processed foods within your diet, and people lost their minds when she said that.
Okay.
But she was quite clearly displaying that if your gut is out of alignment, best believe the link to your brain means that you probably some of the challenges in your brain are there. And I looked up, and forgive me for how I pronounce this, but lactobius reuteri.
Lactobacillus reuteri.
Yeah. Yep. They looked at a study with animals and they found it reduced anxiety in the animals when they managed to get their gut more where it needed to be. Yep. Now, we live in a time of high anxiety, high levels of depression. I wonder if we could address that area of our lives, we would see those lowered. And you said happy there, didn't you? So that's where my mind immediately went.
Definitely. I mean, the link between the gut and the brain, as I mentioned at the start, is still not fully understood. But we do see that in patients with, for example, advanced liver disease, there's an increased rate of depression. Like 40% of these patients who are hospitalized have depression. And after a fecal transplant, some of them have resolved depression. So what's going on there? Not sure. The notion that our mental health crisis is driven by maximally processed, high sugar content food, I think there's some truth to that. But it's not clear to me if it's a consequence of the microbiome or it's a consequence of being more overweight and more sedentary. I'm not sure. I don't know.
Chicken and egg situation again.
I don't know. I mean, I think for a lot, so, you know, a lot of people that are depressed or anxious have altered dietary habit. And it's not clear if it's a virtue of their depression or their anxiety or it's driving their depression or anxiety. You know, I don't think there is a medical intervention that's as good as a regimented, regular, appropriately crafted exercise regime for your mental well-being. Can't see it. And when you speak to, I mean, you can listen to someone called Tim Ferriss talk about his challenges of mental health. And I rate what he says. He talks a lot about exercise being his savior. Now, one of the problems is if you're depressed and you're clinically depressed, you don't want to get out of bed because you're depressed. So how do you get someone like that exercising? It's really hard, isn't it? Particularly if you're severely depressed, it's this critical, life-threatening condition. But there's some principles that I think, as I said, if we apply to everybody, then we'd have less of that and we'd be able to treat things faster and so on. It might be that, you know, diet plus exercise plus an SSRI is better than just an SSRI. That kind of makes sense, right? So for me, I've been through 7 years of startup, scale up, 2 degrees, and all the ups and downs that come with that. And been close to burning out a couple of times for sure. I know what the warning signs are, you know, you're twitching in your muscles, twitching eyelids, wake up before your alarm, feel tense all the time.
Under-recovered from your training.
Yeah, under-recovered from your training, don't feel up for training. Worried that your training is going to push you to the next...
Sex drive, James?
Sex drive, yeah, libido goes, appetite goes, ability to find enjoyment in things you otherwise would goes, work becomes overwhelming, you don't know what to do next, the thought of doing your podcast becomes overwhelming, what if it doesn't go well, and then you've got to do this business trip. So first things first, stress is not necessarily a bad thing. In fact, actually, stress is a very good thing, and it exists because it's a good thing. So if you have some sort of rapid insult or injury, there's a stress response to help you heal. And you need that. You need stress. You need that cortisol boost and that kick. A little bit of stress can improve your performance in the gym and at work, and it's probably good for your well-being. But when that stress becomes chronic, long-term, then it starts to have detrimental impacts on your body. So it's all about managing stress, but it's also about making sure that your body is functioning as well as it possibly can to deal with stress, but also just to be fit and healthy. So over the years, I've tried lots of different things. And I've tried lots of different types of diet, lots of different types of training regime, be it weight training, be it cardio, tried lots of different supplements, tried prescription, non-prescription medication, sometimes off-label, and gone through that journey of self-experimentation. And then more recently, over the last few years, there's been a bit of a spiritual awakening insofar as yoga's become really important, the breathing exercise has become really important, the cold water has become very, very important. Some entrepreneurs have experimented quite successfully with psychedelics, LSD, psilocybin in various different dose regimens. Ketamine for depression. Some people microdose on ketamine. But I just focus on the basics because I think the basics are the most powerful. So it's good nutrition. It's like a Mediterranean type diet. Now people say Mediterranean diet all the time. What do they mean? It means olive oil's flowing through your veins. It means your plate are always full of colour and fibre and veg. It means if you're eating meat, it's grass-fed, organic, wild, free-roaming, not pumped full of antibiotics. It means you're not consuming any processed, sugary foods, unless it's in moderation. For me, it's basically no alcohol at all. And I've been through various different phases of my life. You know, at university, we consume quite a lot. During early professional years, wouldn't drink during the week, and then would drink, you know, Friday, Saturday, sometimes Sunday. And then over time, it's just basically become nothing, like pretty much zero. One drink every few months, one cocktail every few months, or if I'm on holiday, one drink with dinner in the evening. Why is that? For me, hangover is a waste of time. I have 1,700 days of sleep tracking, and without a doubt, it has an impact on my sleep. And sleep is one of the other basic foundational core pillars,
yeah.
Because people take these nootropics and try and do all this to, you know, improve their productivity and their concentration and their mental agility and focus. Getting 5 hours sleep a night, or having a coffee at 5 p.m. What are you doing? Sleep is the most powerful cognitive enhancer in the world. Now, the problem is, if you're really stressed and your sleep is one of the first things to go, you get less restful sleep. You don't get as much deep sleep. Your sleep cycles are shorter. And you wake up before your alarm because you get that cortisol boost that tips you over the edge before when you'd normally want to wake up. And that's a self-perpetuating vicious cycle, which can become really bad. The other elements are exercise. And for me, it's some weight training, usually myself, sometimes with a PT just to blast me. And over the last 6 months, I've been getting more into cardiovascular training.
I've seen you do your hikes and stuff like that as well, which obviously are cardiovascularly challenging.
Loving it. And I did my first Munro race this Saturday past, which was a humbling experience. Because I'd never done anything like that before. I rocked up, 9 Munros, 20 miles. So big race. And I could not believe how fast some of these people were moving. I was like, how is that even possible? And I was right at the back, pretty much within like 20 minutes. But I loved it. And it's just one of those things. It's a challenge. And I've also been training for this half Ironman. So I've been doing a lot of swimming, joined a swim club, got a bike, been doing some big cycles. And I have to say, I think these epic races and Ironman, not sure how good that is for your health, but it's a release. And having something to look forward to after work and something to train for, I think, is really important, so you don't become all consumed.
Being able to snap out of things and have complete presence in your activity is very important, and it often requires a level of physical challenge, which makes your mind shut off from what am I going to say to this member of staff that's been causing me problems, or what about this new project, like what strap line should we use for that, or what, how am I going to position this with investors, whatever thoughts are going through somebody like your head. The physical challenge of running up a Munro, you can't really be thinking about these things if you want to perform well. And it's great to be able to snap away from that. It's funny because you and I come from a similar generation in terms of interest in fitness, where probably our role model when we started lifting would have been somebody like Z's. And throwing around heavyweight, smashing pre-workouts.
Yeah, exactly that.
And don't get me wrong, he had a profoundly positive impact 100%. On people's health and their fitness. 100%. And he's come up numerous times across the podcast with people of similar age to 100%. You and I, and he's had a great impact in that regard. But if you look at how you train now for longevity and for performance and for escape from your work, that's probably not the best way to do it as well. And you and I both know Sean Lazzarini, who's been doing some boxing coaching for myself, because at the start of this year, I pretty much always trained for aesthetics. I had a short flirtation with functional CrossFit style training during the lockdowns, where I was using a garage gym to train, and that was the kind of workouts that I was being allowed to do during that period. So I was like, okay, crack on. But I never really connected with it in the same way that I connected with training for aesthetics and that kind of bodybuilding style training. But going to Sean, I've tested my cardiovascular to another level, because boxing is incredibly challenging in that regard. But I also felt, and this is something that people maybe would think is controversial, but I feel as a man, I should be physically capable as well as look physically capable, because I could stand next to a boxer and I'm pretty muscular, I'm pretty lean, but he would knock me out in 2 seconds flat. Whereas by doing some form of training on a weekly basis with him and starting to scale that up, I'm becoming more capable of, one, defending myself and defending those around me, which I think is an important thing from a primal masculine perspective. And we can talk about toxic masculinity, but I think that's a positive expression of masculinity in that regard. And I find it interesting that more people of our age group are, I want to say, graduating from the traditional, let's get a pump, bro, to, okay, I want to look good, but I want to perform well too.
I agree with you. Z's did have an impact on my life for sure, because he inspired me and others. And there was other role models as well at the time.
Who else did you like? Greg Plitt, people like that?
No, I didn't. I did like Z's a lot. And then for a while, it was bodybuilding and powerlifting and Westside Barbell, and I was involved in the Aberdeen University Weightlifting Club and the formation of that. So I competed in powerlifting for a few years. Never actually thought about competing in physique or bodybuilding. And for the Z's thing, it wasn't just about being shredded and being aesthetic. I found his mindset quite inspirational. Like, you can be whatever you want to be, bro.
His attitude to life,
you know, and he was positive and fun and engaging and charismatic. His death was very sad, and who knows where he would have gone, you know, as a role model.
Imagine with TikTok and Instagram what he would have done, because at the time he had Facebook and YouTube.
Yeah, he would have been huge. He did inspire, I think, the generation below us. Maybe inspire is the wrong word, but steroid use and like aggressive steroid use in the generation below us, I think, has been quite rife. And that's been driven by unrealistic expectations based on social media, access, and poor education around the potential detrimental impacts. And there were some people several years below me at school who were absolutely huge and jacked and on trend and really hardcore stuff that you would only expect a professional
somebody competing in the Olympia would consider that to be a worthwhile risk, whereas you going to Ibiza,
no mad. But you know yourself that people train the whole year for that holiday in Ibiza. They plan their cycles for that holiday in Ibiza. I think that is ridiculous and outrageous and not healthy. And sad, actually, because you see these people when they're on holiday and they're kind of always breathing in and tense and just making sure no one looks at them. And it's like, man, you're on holiday.
Yeah, body dysmorphia is rife as well. And I've got a guest planned to discuss that with, because he's written some really good literature on it, because I think it is rife due to social media and some of the challenges around that. But I really think that, and this is perhaps challenging, because when I've spoken to guests that are really into functional fitness and they're like, oh, you can build a fantastic physique, I'm always like, all the people that say that did bodybuilding first.
Yep.
All the guys that are like super into CrossFit now and look good, they did bodybuilding first and they have the base layer of muscle. And whenever somebody's like, oh, that's how do I improve on this particular thing, I'm always like, probably do some bodybuilding and then do the functional stuff. And the functional stuff will have massive reward, endorphins, performance,
endorphins,
longevity and health, fantastic. But if you want to look the way that, let's name drop an Ollie Marchand looks, you probably need to have, one, elite genetics, two, years of bodybuilding training, and then you can go and do some of the ski ergs and the assault bike stuff like that, because that's probably not going to build the physique that you think it's going to build.
Yeah, I'm not sure who that person is, but I think what you're saying is he looks amazing and he's doing all this crazy stuff. So the genetics is obviously huge. And I think for a lot of people who make a living off their body, some of them are very open about what it's like and how rubbish it is most of the time. Because to look like that, you've got to sacrifice, and your day revolves around how do I maintain this?
Yep.
Rather than how, for someone like me and you who, look, no one is going to remember me for running Munro's. Even if I did Everest with no supplemental oxygen and then did K2 after, okay, maybe some people would know me for that. The way I see it is people will know me, and I want to be me because I want to develop a new medicine. So anything that I'm doing should be complementary to that goal, because that's a very big goal.
That's incredibly interesting as a point, because you know, I certainly know that my training has come before things before, and how the validation from being the shredded guy has been a massive thing for me. And I am fortunate in a number of ways that for whatever reason, my hormonal profile means that I can hover at a very lean body fat and not feel some of the downsides that some people have. I have a phenomenal metabolism and thyroid, whatever else it means. I eat a lot of food and stay this way. But I'm also outrageously disciplined when it comes to, I walk my steps every week, never miss. Mm-hmm. I hit my training sessions every week. I track 90% of what I put in my mouth every week. I actually have had some challenges around processed foods that I've started to think about from content like yourselves and some of the other people that I've engaged with over the last few months, where I've started to think about how it makes me feel as well as how it makes me look. Because we also come from a generation where if it fits your macros became huge.
Yeah, for sure.
And again, that did free people from some of the disordered eating patterns they were in, where they would eat
chicken and rice,
quote unquote, clean for 5 days, have a cheat meal and think it was replenishing glycogen or whatever else, and think that was okay. But really that was kind of a manifestation of a challenging relationship with food. But if it fits your macros went far too far, where I remember putting stuff on top of my oats, it was just junk. I remember getting to the end of the day and being like, I'm going to have all these fruit pastels. And don't get me wrong, I'm not going to demonize a particular sweet or whatever else, but it's probably not as good as if I had 180 calories of fruit and veg or whatever else, because it would treat my microbiome well, et cetera, et cetera. But there's it's funny the information improvement that we've seen during our starting fitness to the age of both 30 now.
The If It Fit Your Macros thing was huge for a long time, wasn't it? And it was like, look at me eating my bowl of ice cream and you mentioned fruit pastels, so I use fruit pastels and I'm getting my macros in. It doesn't matter what I eat. Look at me, I'm shredded. And I think there's something to be said for that. But you wouldn't eat like that if you wanted to be the best in the world at ice hockey or marathon or weightlifting. So if you want to be the best in the world at podcasting, then you need to look at other pursuits of excellence and mirror them. And you know, you being shredded and in great shape is part of your persona, it's part of your brand. You know, if you were coming on here totally out of shape, speaking to fitness professionals and speaking to your audience about what's important, what's not important, what you say might be exactly the same, but like it or not, if you don't walk the walk, there is less credibility.
The messenger counts. 100%.
Yeah, and one of the other reasons that I work so hard at the wellness piece is that I'm a leader of an organization. And you know, I don't have a massive social media following or whatever, but I do have, you know, 80 odd people working at Enterobiotics, and some people do listen to what I say. And I think it's really important as a leader to walk the walk and practice what you preach. Being a leader, the title leader is not something you give to yourself. Anyone that says I'm a leader is not someone worth listening to. Leader is an honor bestowed upon you by people that follow you. So, and it's about character traits. It's about discipline. It's about values. So every CEO's got their own style. My style and my ethos and philosophy is I want to be healthy, happiness, enthusiastic. I'm going to put the work in every day on my body and my microbiome. So that's gym and all the other things.
Has that developed over time, or did you start out, as soon as you started to bring people on board, you said, I'm going to lead from the front in this regard?
there's always been interest in health and fitness, for sure. It does go back to the Z's times, and maybe even before that, I wanted to be strong for rugby.
You played rugby league, didn't you?
Rugby league, rugby union, never exceptional. However, I think if I had the mindset that I have now, I think I could have been much, much better, because I had a lot of the key ingredients. Tall, reasonably fast, could kick well, could pass well, was quite big. I think I could have been much better than I was. But what I didn't have then was a coach who kind of helped me develop the mindset I have now, which is like, impossible is nothing. If I want to do something, whether it's learn another language, learn how to cook, learn how to dance, I'm doing it. I'm going to do it really quickly, and I'm going to immerse myself in it. I didn't have that then. That's developed over time. But my own focus has refined over the years, as I've said, and has got better, I think. And it's become more and more important to me over the years, because I realize that to be the best leader and the best CEO, I need to be in my best possible shape and condition. I need to try and manage stress, so it's blooming hard. And people recognize that and follow that. But the flip side, to be fair, is, you know, there's a bit of a joke at Interbiotics that when I go away, there's like a McDonald's delivery or something like that, you know? And I think you also need to recognize that not everyone's like you, and not everyone wants to drink green juice every day. That's okay. I don't look down on people for doing what they want to do. And I'm sometimes a little bit worried that the culture of Interbiotics becomes a bit too rigid, you know? So I've started to dress down a little bit more and not wear the suit and the tie, even though it was part of the brand, and be more free with my conversations with people in the company and say, yeah, you know, go and order that, whatever it is you want to order. Don't be hiding under the table, you know, when I walk past because you've got a bacon roll in your hand. Just,
of course.
Just
as,
do it.
As long as they're happy with the choices, I think that's the key thing. So one of the common questions I get on the solo podcast, which I do kind of every 10, I'll get 25 to 30 questions from Instagram and my email list, is like, what do you do when you're a high performer and you want to manage your self-talk, or you want to manage your identity and your behaviors, and you're like, am I behaving in line with my values? One of the things is always just make sure that you are behaving in line with your values. So if your identity is James, the founder that leads from the front in terms of his body, his brain, his gut, you probably need to behave in alignment with that. Otherwise, of course, your self-talk will be negative. You'll be like, look, I really fucked up there. Whereas if on a Friday or a Saturday you decide that the dinner out with family, friends, a loved one, whatever it is worth stepping out of alignment with your dietary values, then you've made that decision consciously. Whereas somebody being like, oh, it's Fat Friday in the office, and you probably don't want to have the bacon roll and the
Friday, yeah. We don't do that.
No, of course not. But I remember going into that culture and being like, is that a thing?
Yeah.
What the fuck? But like, that's just how I'm wired. Yeah. But there'll be people sat there that don't want to do that as well. In the same way, like after work drinks in London when I go down there with work, I don't think I've ever drank with the company I'm at just now. No, I haven't at any of the parties or the functions. And there'll be the occasional person there that won't be drinking as well. And they'll be like, I'm so glad you're not drinking because it means I don't need to. And I'll be like, no.
Yeah.
Like, I'll regularly be the only person that's not drinking in a room, but I make a conscious effort to be the way I am now, extroverted, engaged, present. Whereas if I turned up sober to the after work drinks when we're in this bar in Shoreditch or wherever, and I sat on my phone doing my emails or doing my Instagram or doing my podcast work, they'd be like, Colin's fucking boring. I wish he was drinking. Yep. Because if I was drinking, I wouldn't be doing that. I'd be with them at the bar, like chatting away, buying drinks, whatever else. So I think whenever you're looking at like being your best self or whatever else, or living in line with whatever your peak version is, as long as when you deviate from that, you're conscious and you're happy you've done it and you don't feel you've done it through peer pressure or through a moment of weakness or temptation, then I think you can be much happier in who you are as an individual. And I think your self-talk will be much better off the back of it.
Mm-hmm. Totally agree. I mean, don't get me wrong. Love a cheesecake. I do mainly eat plants, but I like a char-grilled steak. So it's not 100% rigid all the time.
But when you choose to have that, though, you do.
I like my vibey as well, you know. I do seriously like vibey.
Yeah, I'm super proud of what Gordon's done with it.
I take the greens, and that's part of my morning routine, you know. And you asked me, you know, what I do. It's routine's really important, you know. So waking up early, not looking at your phone, and getting your sups in, stretching, doing your breath work, have a cold shower, same every day, same routine every morning. sometimes even when I'm on holiday, to be honest with you, because it's just how it is.
And the type of holiday you're going on is probably enabling you to do that as well.
Well, so it's something I've not been very good at all over the last few years is actually taking holidays, because there's always been something, you know, because when you're building a scale-up business that's growing really quickly, there's always a million fires to put out. And even with a team around you, you know, you feel like, I've just do that. And some of the holidays I've had have ended up being work, which has sucked. It's really stressful. And the time historically that I have had to unplug, I've just done so much in every day because I'm like type A personality kind of thing. However, one of my kind of New Year's resolutions, which hasn't come to fruition yet, but it's going to next week because I'm going holiday, is to try and just stop for at least a couple of days and just lie down and read a book. Because every weekend, you know, it's always been, well, I'm doing this Munro, that Munro, I'm training for this race, I'm training for the half Ironman. You know, I'm doing this, want to start another company, want to write a book, want to do my podcast, all this kind of stuff. So next week I am planning on just chill, man.
I managed to do it too.
Just chill.
Yeah. I managed to do it a couple of weeks ago and I spoke about being holiday calling rather than
nice
normal calling.
That's good.
And it meant that I drank 4 times out of 7 days, which I haven't done since I was like 21 or something like that. And we just went for it and just enjoyed
holiday calling sounds fun.
Yeah. Well, fun at the time because I was completely happy with it. There was no productivity guilt, which I think is one of the massive things with somebody with a personality type that's similar to you or I. When you aren't doing the thing, you're like, oh,
yeah.
You know that time that I spent doing that? I could have been doing this instead. Yep. And that's a terrible weight, but also it's a driving factor. But just being completely embracing it. So like Holiday James is not going to look at his phone. He's not going to look at his emails. Yeah. He's not going to take that call, which he normally would. Yeah. Or that weekly investor call at 3 p.m. on a Thursday, whatever, because it meets up with the US and it meets up with whoever else.
Yep, you got it.
My out of office is on for that. Unfortunately, I can't make that. And I think you'll come back better for it. Like, I've come back after I recovered from the alcohol and the poison in my body. Yeah. I'm flying right now. Day job, podcast, training's back where it needs to be. And I'm excited to do it because I took 7 days where I didn't really do it at all. I sent a couple of emails. I sent a couple of messages to guests on WhatsApp because that was just maintenance level and I didn't have to really put in any effort for that. It was effortless because that doesn't feel like work as well, which is another thing too. But when I came back, I'm back into the groove and I'm feeling good for it. And I wonder how good you'll be when you come back from a holiday.
Hopefully I'm tanned, relaxed, just ready for anything. And I'm hungry. I'm hungry about everything I'm doing. But to maintain the intensity, I think there does need to be some downtime, like you say. It's interesting to hear your perspective. So I'll give you a shout when I come back.
Yeah.
I'm hoping just, you know, total relax, read some books, have a couple of cocktails, sun, swim in the sea, you know, all this good stuff. So
sounds good.
South of Portugal.
One of the things that I want to know is what would success look like for you in 10 years' time?
An approved drug for multiple different patient populations, which is distributed in global markets. And that's saving lives and allowing people to live longer, healthier, happier. A superb return for the investors and the shareholders in Enterobiotics. A workforce of happy, engaged people who are proud to work for the company and who embody the values and are happy to be there. A good relationship with my family. And a sense of fulfillment with regards to what I'm doing. I want to stay in the shape that I'm in and be healthy and happy to enjoy my success. I think it's really important, right? And maybe find a partner for life. I'm single at the moment. I very much enjoy being single, but I do feel that if you can find somebody who compliments you, then you can get more out of life and you can enjoy and share the success with somebody else. That it's not that I'm
it's healthy.
Not going to be successful in 10 years if I'm still single. But hopefully that gives you a sense of, from a career point of view, from a personal life point of view, what's important to me. It's about making the company successful, helping people, continuing to work on myself and having a good relationship with my family and friends, and being a son, brother, uncle, friend, colleague that people are proud to know.
It's all really aligned though.
Setting good example for people. I don't have any metrics like, oh, I want to be a billionaire, or I want to sell a company for £500 million, or I want to have two cars and a villa in Ibiza and a castle in da da da. That's not what success looks like for me. Success is about health, happiness, societal impact, and being somebody that people look up to. The other thing as well, which is really important, is having a clean conscience and putting your head on the pillow every night, knowing that you're doing good things and you may have made mistakes, but you recognize them. You don't have any beef with people and you don't have lots of aggro in your life that you've created. That, I think, is success. And I've met a lot of billionaires over the years. And I've only met a couple who are actually happy. And those people embody the things that I've talked about. Family, self-development, societal impact.
So there's some clues there.
For sure. Absolutely. And at the end of the day, happiness is... happiness and fulfillment are the most important things, I think.
It's what we're chasing.
Happiness, fulfillment, and love for close people around you. Love for what you do. And being excited to get up in the morning every day. If you're excited to get up in the morning every day, you are winning. You're absolutely winning. If you dread every day, dread your work, don't like your body, feel like you're injured all the time, you're not winning. So I hope that in 10 years, I'm still as driven as I am now. I've got that same sense of purpose that I do now. And I you know, today I woke up and I thought, you know, today's going to be a great day. Look at what's on for me today. Look at what's on for me tomorrow. On Friday looks great as well. That's a great place to be.
Yeah, great place to be and a great place for us to wrap up, James. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
If people want to continue the conversation, where should they head towards?
You can go to the Inside Masters podcast, which is the podcast that I host, which is like hardcore gut microbiome, gut health content. So speak about that for hours. You can go to my personal website, jamesmcelroy.com. I'm on Instagram, it's Dr. James McElroy, although not super, super active. On LinkedIn as well, just Dr. James McElroy. I hope that some of the people listening have got something from this. I've really enjoyed it a lot. Thank you for what you're doing. And it was a pleasure.
Pleasure too, James. I really enjoyed it. I'm sure the listeners will as well. And I'll be back to speak to you all again very, very soon.